Blog Talk Radio.
Share some time, talk. Maybe about things interesting, maybe about things in Sonic, who knows. But maybe we'll agree to disagree, maybe we'll find some interesting things going on. And move the understanding of Freemasonry ahead by putting a little bit of context around some of the very significant ideas that have brought us as far as we have come along. Hello, I'm your, this is Masonic Companion. I'm your host for this episode. You can call me Graham. This is the 61st day of the year, believe it or not. Year's charging along quite nicely. The 2nd of March. We're coming up to, I can tell the excitement is growing out there just from the way you're all carrying on. The spring equinox is coming. Those of you who are, I hope you didn't fall out of your chair with that news. All you druidic types, you can get out your robes and head for the hill and watch the, get out there at 12:57 p.m., mind you, here in the northern, in this part of the world, the northern hemisphere. It reckons the first day of spring, according to the planet and the sun. Whether it's whether the weather is the key, whether or not the temperature and climate agree with our notions of spring, the tilt is happening. The sun is hovering over the equator. Yeah, doesn't necessarily mean that winter can't come back. You know, you can get these really bad storms well into March and April. That's part of life here in Canada. Great, great country here. Interesting place. Cityites keep whining a little, whining about the weather, but the rest of us sort of notice that where we're living, it snows. It gets cold. And then after that, it gets warm, hot, and then it gets in between. The seasons are when it's good, it's incomparable. And it makes up for all the grayness and silliness. For all those of you who sit back and lie in the grass and look at the stars like the shepherds used to, and the scientists in China used to, the signs of spring begin to appear. The zodiac constellation Leo the Lion has been rising up in the eastern sky already since February, as you know, with its six, you know, that question mark, the six star shape. And now in March, it will be well up in the east as soon as it gets dark. So take a look for it. And all the bright and beautiful winter constellations are Orion. You don't have to wait until late into the night to see Orion. Taurus and Gemini and Canis Major and Aruga. These are all shifted over to the west and southwest skies because of the Earth orbiting the sun. But there's still, most of them are there. And you can see them until midnight. So get out, you know, there's still that early darkness that allows us to take advantage of it. If it's the summertime, you know, you're waiting until, what, 10 o'clock before the stars start to really pop. Now, Mars is just a month away from its first opposition in 2 years. And that's when it'll be best for the people like me that like to get out and watch the sky. So it's only a month away. And the opposition is when a planet appears to lie opposite the sun in the sky from the Earth's perspective. And so Mars will seem to rise in the east as the sun sets in the west next month. So for now, in early March, Mars will rise about 9:30 in the east. And it will rise by 7:30 p.m. at the end of the month. So, you know, get out there and take a look. When you see that coming up in the east, now you'll know. Work that one into your conversation. I'm sure it's likely to be a lively topic when you say, hey, you know what, that bright, that's not a star, that's a planet over there. That's the one that's all the chit-chat and the yakitiness is about. Are we going to be able to inhabit it? Now we're finding that the calculators, the theorists are telling us there are hundreds of thousands of possible Goldilocks planets, situations like ours, not, you know, Goldilocks, not too hot, not too cold, the porridge, eh? So the analogy is that where you can find the right temperatures and the right amount of moisture to grow a planet or create a planet like Earth. Hundreds of thousands of potential planets like this scattered through the universe. If ever there's the horizon is still the same, though, isn't it? And it takes people of courage to look over the edge and see what's coming. Rightfully so, I think we also have to realize that we can go off in all directions and build our contemporary pyramids, but it's really important to take care of us while we're here. We've got a lot of people suffering, a lot of people going hungry. And our brethren in the Ukraine, whether you're being persecuted over there by the you know, misdirected politics and superstitions or not, I know I speak on behalf of everybody. We wish you well. I hope you and yours are safe. It's trying times. So let's, I was reading this week something that's kind of interesting. You may have heard of the poet Robert Frost. Takes a lot of stick, does Robert. Looked at by the highbrows as a bit of a simple fellow. Remember this, he played with the term the sound of sense. What we find now is that, you know, like a lot of things in the day seemed to be dismissed, but now the work is, you know, his work is being appreciated in a much different way for what it is, so I have some of his quotes sitting here in front of me. An interesting man. He said, "In three words, I can sum up everything I've learned about life." Huh. The three words, it goes on. Forgive me my nonsense, as I also forgive the nonsense of those that think they talk sense. Not exactly. And then I was reading this article about, you know, the criticism of Robert Frost. I don't know whether the editors meant it on purpose, but I pretty presume they did. They had preceded that one with an article on mathematics and how some of the major unproven mathematical problems, the ones that cause that quickening pace when somebody can become so excited by a mathematical problem, that even the simplest, the complex, even the simple problems can defy a resolution or a proof. And even the most complex can be broken down into its simplest terms and still be very, very difficult to understand. So if people are looking at at complexity and saying, well, that must be genius. Really? In a world where we've been, you know, we have this schism going on, it's interesting for somebody to try and be claiming that. I noticed particularly around North America, in a lot of places, there's this chant in the background that to accept yourself and be who you are. And then there's this, the chorus is singing this other tune about self-improvement. Always improve yourself. You can do better. You can reshape this or remove that or, you know, find yourself. Well, if you're accepting yourself, how is it that you've got to change so much in order to be what other people think you should be? Seems a bit odd to me. A person will sometimes devote all his life to the development of one part of his body, says Robert Frost. And a part? The wishbone. Home is the place where when you have to go there, they have to take you in. But I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep. And miles to go before I sleep. I didn't know he said that. He says, I'm not confused. I'm just not well mixed. Maybe we can all defend ourselves this week with that kind of a notion. The diplomat is a man who always remembers a woman's birthday, but never remembers her age. Meanwhile, stomp around in all the manliness you can, if that's what you got to do. But there's a little bit of diplomacy here. I'll leave this for now. Poetry, he says, is when an emotion has found its thought and the thought has found words. Could be. Makes sense to me. A little bit of the talk today about the lightness of being gray. I mean that I was noticing that in between these, we keep going through transition of learning and understanding. Masonically, all ritual, metaphor, symbolism, and metaphysics reveals answers to questions. Is there purpose in the universe, and do I have a role? Those are my version of it. We think that not asking such questions is a sign of ignorance. We assume the universe can be understood. In between, we live in a gray soup, our research incomplete. Writers like Worshipful Brother Andrew Hammer tell us the priority, unobstructed, is the craft. Impatience distracts us from our questions. Our instruction of apprentices describing functions, what they're to do, drops off without defining attempting philosophy. What benefit can a disinterested man receive being urged to do more group functions with no mention of metaphysics? But we do. Attend this, go there, eat that, stand this way, dress that way. Always with the group, Almost to the point where it's what's expected in the Holy Grail is compliance. It's an unpleasant specter, wouldn't you say? We want to believe we have the power to passively rehabilitate a man against the natural course of his life. And of course we don't. Isn't that our own conceit? We can do this collectively. This thing, this ubiquitous thing that is called the craft. Well, the craft is us. It's not something abstract. Do we really want to believe morality can be measured by membership and performance? Morality, you know, that the betterment, a good man better. Is that how we measure it? by your membership in this organization, and then your performance in that. That's it, huh? Really? That's good enough? Well, good luck to us if it is. Thomas Gray wrote in 1792, "Thought would destroy their paradise. No more where ignorance is bliss, 'tis folly to be wise." Neither privilege, rank, or wealth is a measure of insight. Despite what the wags, the venture capitalists, and the wealthy are claiming, this social experiment in capitalism is showing its age. Just like all of the other social experiments have, community and society seems to be the one laboratory of humanness that we want to explore and tinker. We want to play with it most of all. And so we're always tinkering, trying to improve it. And in the meantime, it's probably better than what was replaced. But the measure of insight, do you think privilege does it? Obviously not. Rank or wealth, obviously not. But when we see such imbalance, 85 people holding the wealth equivalent of half of the human race, the lower half of the human race, something is wrong. Something is drastically wrong. This creature's dying, and we don't seem to be doing a whole lot about it yet. We don't even like the problems that we criticize the problems as if they are, external to the processes. The problem is grinding poverty and hunger. Motivation as hubris, really? Fear of failure, is that what motivates us? Do we brag? Is motivation to brag? Is that what motivates us? Is it guilt? Those seem at odds with an enriched philosophical environment. Freemasonry expects a man to fulfill his commitments and to be aware of the needs of others. That's magical thinking, isn't it? To be aware of others. Quieting one's ego is very difficult. Me. Even the me generation didn't sustain it, did they? Did we? Masonic Companion continues to use expositional and critical references. Expositional, we're just exposing material, new ideas. And then we're trying to examine them critically with you, with your help. With part of this makes sense. And we're doing this not for any reason of competition, my Lord, but we're doing it to explore the basics, the basic ideas. It tends to be important, doesn't it? Yeah. Today we're going to get into brought a little bit of music along, of course. And which I think is important, and I want to share just a little piece with you. This is a story. It's sort of a somber piece. And when I heard about it, I was a much younger man. And when I heard about the story that it told, it was touching. It's about a man. You probably know him. He's a singer, when he was much younger, he spent some time in a hospital. He had a breakdown. It was still back in the day when people mocked folks for being unable to cope. Not so much anymore. Not that we've received any enlightenment, but we've now been exposed to personal histories, men and women coming back from the battlefields. Be interesting, an interesting statistic for people like me that grew up during the Vietnam War. The average age of a soldier in Vietnam, American soldier in Vietnam, was 19. And they often, their term wasn't long, but every single day of it, they would be receiving intense fire. It makes you wonder. This man was in hospital, and his good friend. This is a song about what happened to his friend. Listen to it. You think, doesn't it? The last time I saw you might be the last time I ever see you. I just hope that we parted on good terms, and so that I have a memory that will linger and make me feel proud. It's not a bad point to navigate around throughout your life, is it? Darn those Greeks for getting into our heads. Man thought he'd see her again, and She took her own life. Ah, man, stuff happens. Stuff happens constantly. I want you to share with me, and I hope all the initiated speculative and accepted Freemasons out there will know just how proud we should be to be part of this great organization. We do things that are very, very, very interesting. Very interesting. You know, in 1891, the Cherokee Indians agreed to sell the Cherokee Strip to the United States. Now, it's far beyond my pay grade to try and figure out how Native people were, the extortion that went on in North America a long time ago. But, you know, the lawmakers have this in their view. And, you know, one thing about the North America, it will eventually get around to some form of reconciliation. And none too soon, if you want to ask me. But in 1891, the last of the independent lodges of Scotland joined the Grand Lodge. Did you know that? It was also the time, in 1894, a war started between Japan and China. They're still like to flex with each other, and Captain Alfred Dreyfus was found guilty of betraying secrets to the French army. He was later vindicated. Did you know that? But shortly after 1893, Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, became a Mason in Phoenix Lodge number 257 in Portsmouth, England. The very next year, the Anti-Masonic Bureau was established by Pope Leo XIII. A lot going on constantly. In 1888, the publication of the first transactions of Quattro Cornati Lodge number 2076 of London. They have been published yearly to the present time. That was the same year that George Eastman invented the film camera. And a practical adding machine was invented by Burroughs. You know? And that was the year that Arthur Sullivan, 1887, this is interesting for you, I think, of Gilbert and Sullivan served as the grand organist of the Grand Lodge of England. Can you imagine? Irving Berlin, most of you have grown up and lived at a period when he was alive. Well, he was born in Russia, and he became a member of Mum Lodge number 190 in New York. Again, the musicians, the artists. Huh? Nathaniel Pitt Langford published in 1890 The Vigilante Days and Ways, in which he explained how the craft organized law and order in Montana. He was a Grand Master there in 1869, by the way. John Philip Sousa was made a Mason in Hiram Lodge number 10 in Washington. 1882, First Alberta Canada Lodge was chartered. 1884, fountain pen was invented by Louis E. Waterman. Thank you, Louis. Nice work. The same year, Pope Leo XIII issued his bull, Humanum Genus, on the 20th of April, directed against the craft. Papal bulls were like a directive, you know, from the boss. Always, always on top of it. Rudyard Kipling in 1886, he was made a Mason in Hope and Perseverance. I need somebody younger or older to help. Perseverance Lodge number 782 in Lahore, India. We talked about Mr. Kipling last week, how much he loved his son. We'll go back over this a little bit. So much of, you know, there's so many events. And when we find out, the connection is, we find out that the fellows involved in these things were Masons. And it always teases us a bit to say whether it's Masonry that's causing this, Or it's the nature of a man who joins a Masonic order. Is there something about the nature of you, us, of us, that suppression of ego, thinking about the betterment of other people, and not just, I don't mean just the people that just flap their gums and haven't got a clue. No, I'm not talking about that. But it's also to say, do we know that all of these fellows understood the nuance, the philosophy, the discourse, the ethos of Freemasonry? We don't know that. We presume it. But as a body of work, there's so much happening. And Freemasons are involved so often. And they're men whose name have trickled down to us through history that it's hard to begin to just be glib about it and think, you know, this would just seem to be a coincidence. Perhaps, like it does for me and probably a lot of you, we find a way of promoting the, you know, stabilizing ourselves. Yes, let's put it that way. Stabilizing through conversation, through discussion, through through an enlightenment, yeah? Yeah, of course. Anyway, we'll put that aside and we'll come back to it, I hope. I'm just sitting here, you know, this is just fascinating periods of history. And of course it helps us to understand how much, you know, in an imperfect world, how important are the lessons? Well, if the boys that came before us didn't have the wherewithal and the knowledge to pass on the information, then we can see how it could easily be lost. The majority of people doing research in Freemasonry aren't Freemasons. Aren't. There's exaggerations constantly. No, it's not. It's about the... It's scholars, academics that are doing the work. And why shouldn't they? Of course. And anybody that would think that it wouldn't, you know, we don't deserve that type of thing or nobody has business, that's just daft. That's just daft. This organization is a phenomenon that's been around for hundreds of years, addressing thought that has been around for, what would you say, longer than that? I would think we should open our eyes and our ears and take a look at what the researchers are telling us. What are they discovering about us? There's a lot going on. Now, I'm going to do a little plug here for those who are inclined. Take a look for the Toronto Society for Masonic Research. Yeah, really. You know, take a look. That, I think, is, I think it's fascinating, you know. There's a lot. There's so much about Masonry that's, you know, that's just full of falsehoods. So much information about it. It's just not accurate. Because for a variety of reasons, quality of the research being one of them, but also the information, the availability of you know, a clear, accurate information is improving. Does that, now the question that you would need to ask is, does it matter that the source material is being corrected? And or is it wrong just to ask those types of questions? Does the truth matter? Or is it like my truth or our truth? Don't ask. You know, if this is our truth and we're happy with it, don't ask anything else that makes me re-examine that. That gives me, it should give us all reason to shiver, thinking if that's the case, man, are we in trouble. I think not. I tend not to believe that. And I don't think that it's fair to point fingers at people and say they're just old and they can't think this way. I think that's just wrong-minded. If somebody is Masonically illiterate, if they can mouth words and have no real understanding of they haven't digested the meaning, then age has no bearing on the issue. None. It's just what we would call them. They're daffy. They may be full of themselves, but being loud and offensive doesn't. Usually, those are the types of things that somebody with a really weak idea finds they have to do to try and sell it. You know, it's like the hucksters in the carnival yelling above the crowd to try and get you to come over and look at the knife sharpener that they're hawking that day. This is changing. You get these really weak ideas, and everybody's going to line up and show their flex all of their muscles and prove that they're right. Ha ha. Here, we're going to talk about something really kind of interesting. Yeah, Masonic the Renaissance period. You know, let's talk about that insidious bunch, those Renaissance thinkers. They let the genie out of the box. So now, you know, when you're thinking, I want to talk to you later about this guy, Aleister Crowley. Yeah, so we're going to talk about Aleister. We a little bit flaky out there, Aleister, but oh boy, you know, you've got some, you're messing around with the edges of darkness there, buddy. We're going to have a sit down. And what do you think happened to that kind of, bean counters? Where do you think they went? You think, Aleister was the one and he is just, he was short of a full deck and all those kind of things, and that doesn't exist anymore. Well, really? You want to buy that one? Of course it exists. And of course, the fellows that are doing this aren't about to expose themselves to the mockery. Yes, they would be mocked, and you and I know that. If you pick up a copy of the Book of the Dead, do you think, let's step away from that fellow. He's reading things that seem to make me feel very uncomfortable. I haven't got a clue why, but, you know, he's breaking the rules. He's coloring outside the lines. Let's not talk to him. We're going to ostracize that card. Aleister Crowley exists in somewhere. But where? We'll get into that one day. You know, that's a topic that you and I can talk about. We'll talk about the Freemasonry and Wiccans and Freemasonry and the occult. And yeah, is there some reason we can't pick up the throw a candle into that darkness? Is there? Well, if it's a dark corner and it's got anything to do with us, you know darn well we're going to open that door. Of course we are. We're going to try and understand what in the world is going on. And we're going to try and do it without showing ourselves to be conceited thickheads or mock somebody's belief. Let's give it its due and then make up your mind, you know, one way or the other, whatever. As you always do. I have the advantage of the think tank out there, the listeners here, the advisors. Brilliant. And it helps make sense out of a lot of things that we bring to the show. Absolutely. It's wonderful. Anyway, well, let's get into Scotland, England, Jacobites, and Hanoverians. And the Grahams were Jacobites. Just so, I guess that's a disclosure that I have to make, isn't it? Well, there you have it. And Bonnie Dundee was a Graham. Yes, okay. I'm sorry. Now, apologize but it's also kind of interesting. Anyway, the huge changes inherent in the Reformation not only altered features familiar in medieval life, such as observances by guilds and fraternities during religious festivals, but created a void in which forms of ceremony or ritual could be developed in the secrecy of meetings such as the lodges. There, now it gets interesting, eh? I knew that would get your attention. Got mine. The enormous impact of the English Revolution of the 1640s and 50s clearly left ideas of republicanism and radicalism that had a considerable effect throughout the 18th century, especially through the Netherlands. The scientific revolution that began with Copernicus had reached new heights with the publication of Newton's Philosophiae Naturae Principia Mathematica in 1687, a work that had the profoundest effects on the Enlightenment and especially on the French philosophies. Radicals of the 18th century learned from the Newtonian Revolution a new reverence for nature. But the move to disengage the clergy and establish churches from government that had begun with the English Revolution soon became a part of continental radicalism. Although there was an undercurrent of English republicanism in the 18th century, many shied away from this with memories of the Commonwealth. Newton and Boyle, for example, chose a liberal and moderate, undogmatic type of Christianity in preference to the radicalism of the Puritan sectaries. Remember, we're talking about Puritans. Remember those folks that got in those little boats and came across here? Remember, yeah, this was on the continuum. Puritans were issuing a dogmatic approach to faith. Yeah. Freemasonry in England, firmly associated with Whiggery from 1717, provided a social institution that could promote cultural, political, and undogmatic notions. Members of the craft would acknowledge the god of the new science, the great architect, who was no longer a figure of rage, revenge, and wrath, but the embodiment of order, measurement, and stability. The great architect was a creator, benevolent, truthful, full of grave wisdom, and part of the natural order of things. Got my attention. During the early part of the 18th century, organized Freemasonry became widespread in both the British Isles and on the continent. This spread is closely connected with the rise of the Whig oligarchy and with the growth of British power. Freemasonry was fashionable in the Netherlands and in the Holy Roman Empire, notably in Austria, which is not surprising, for both were allies of Britain in the power struggle with France, and both were aware of British prosperity, of the remarkable constitutional structure, and of the new stability in Britain. That Freemasonry was intensely political can hardly be doubted. The craft may have been brought to Vienna in the wake of Prince Eugen of Savoy, the great military commander and ally of Britain, who had many Freemasons in his entourage. The Duke of Lorraine, Francis, later to become emperor, was initiated as a Freemason in Houghton Hall in Norfolk Walpole's estate in 1731. And at his coronation in 1745, it seems that a Masonic ceremony was held, and many Netherlanders were initiated. In England during the 18th century, Freemasonry was approximately Protestant and was not seen as posing any threat to the established church or to the state. On the contrary, it tended to support both. Yet on the continent, Freemasonry was often denounced as subversive, especially where the Roman Catholic Church was concerned. And it was also perceived as republican and radical. The reasons for this are clear. Freemasonry on the continent tended to be supported by those of a liberal bent who admired England and English constitutions, who revered Newton and his philosophies, and who abhorred absolutism and the clerical and intellectual stranglehold of the old regimes. It was this precise connection with Protestantism and with absolutism, spelling a threat to both church and divinely ordained monarchy, that condemned continental Freemasonry in the eyes of the church. Freemasonry claimed a link with the mysteries of antiquity, but it clearly was also a link with Renaissance Hermeticism, Newtonian science, and the guilds of the past. With its aprons, tools, and other emblems, it evoked a world of the noble craftsman, the dignity of labor, and this creation of noble architecture. It also broke down social barriers. For within the lodge, the aristocrat hobnobbed with the third estate, and, if the aprons and tools were anything to go by, would soon be rubbing shoulders with artisans in the confines of the lodge. An easy socializing that had been a feature of English custom thus spread to the continent and threatened the rigid stratification of society. Oh, here in North America, rigid? Oh, yes. Don't think of this as a picture of everybody standing up with their arms around each other. Oh, no, 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 no. This is a clamor to be on top. In fact, Freemasonry portended a social revolution of continental import. Thus, Freemasonry on the continent began to be seen as subversive, quite unlike its parent organization. Sundials in the Netherlands and in Central Europe are a memorial to the spread of British Freemasonry among her continental allies in the military struggles with France, the epitome of absolutist monarchy. Interesting, huh? The French kings feeling they were divine, you know, the divine, they were the God King. Interesting. Yet from the end of the 16th century, Freemasonry in Scotland seems to have been closely associated with the House of Stuart. And throughout the 17th and the first half of the 18th centuries, this link was maintained. In fact, Freemasonry in France, and where there were emigres from Scotland and Ireland after the Willamite Wars and the 1715 Rebellion, and the events of 1745 and 6, which put paid to the Stuart Restoration hopes, was strongly Jacobite in its leanings. Thank you, France. But yes, only when the Jacobite cause was finally lost did this connection become loose and die away. The association with the Hanoverian camp, and therefore with Whiggery, coincides with the creation of Grand Lodge in 1717. The centralization is probably due to one very important reason, and that is the state of the country after the accession of the Elector George Louis of Hanover to the throne in 1714, and the rebellion of 1715. Which unquestionably involved many Jacobite Freemasons. There was a clear need to control the craft, to purge it of any taint of Jacobite sympathy in order to avoid trouble or even persecution. The result was an overt show of allegiance to the House of Hanover. The Whigs quite clearly determined to set up a powerful Masonic organization which would rival the Jacobite Masonic network, and also the 3 degrees of craft masonry were placed firmly under the control of Grand Lodge. Higher degrees seemed to have been exclusively Jacobite until after 1745. Then, the higher degrees having been purged of Jacobite elements and the danger of a Jacobite restoration having passed, were adopted by English Freemasonry. Eventually, the organization responsible for their craft became United Grand Lodge in the 19th century. Remember, the reconciliation of the ancients and moderns, of course. Interesting period of time. Now, this is the type of conversation I dare say would not take place in most lodges. I would like to think that it could. I would really like to think that it could, because it's informative and it talks about us, doesn't it? Anyway, it's the context. Next time we're going to get into the effect on the design of early lodges. I think it's remarkable, just remarkable. And I'm conscious of the time coming past. So we're coming up to St. Patrick's Day. So I don't want to, you know, infringe. Oh, dear me, I wouldn't want to do that. The Art and Architecture of Freemasonry, that's by James Stevens Curl. I find it a remarkably well-researched bit of work. And just conversationally, so that I know you're all aware of this, but we don't always walk around with, you know, information at our fingertips. So I'm just going to give us a just go over a little bit of the facts. You need, we're coming up to 2013 was 200 years of the United Grand Lodge governance. Of course, now we're coming up to 2017, 300 years of the Premier Grand Lodge. It is important, and certainly led the way to important for us because we chose to maintain a connection, which I think was bright, foresighted, an important connection. Even at the time, we were being ignored. Who were we? These were people that, you know, if there wasn't something in it for them, they weren't necessarily interested in us. There's still men around that are like that. Unless you can, and there's something in it for them, they're not interested in you at all. But I'm not saying anything out of school. You open your eyes, you all know. 200 years ago, and a year, the Grand Lodge was founded, joining together two rival Grand Lodges. The first of these two Grand Lodges was formed in London in 1717, with its first constitution published in 1723. And the second of these Grand Lodges was founded in London in 1751, and with its first constitution published in 1756, 5 years later. So you need those years. One is 6 years later, 6 years to get its first out, the others. The latter called itself the Grand Lodge of England according to the old institution and referred to the former as the Moderns. Eventually, it became known as the Ancients, or with a T, as I spell it. The Moderns, or Premier Grand Lodge, had five editions of its constitution from 1723, 1738, 1756, 1767, 9 years later, and 1784. The Ancients had eight editions, and they called it a Haman Rezon. Now, if the parallels matter to you, 1756, 1764, 1778, and this is after the Premier Grand Lodge had stopped its fifth edition, 1787, 1800, 1801, 07, and 1813. The United Grand Lodge of England was created in December of 1813, with its first constitutions published in 1815 and 1819, in those 4 years, and 1827. And these are called the 6th, 7th, and 8th editions. Now, that just helps sort out a bit of the math for anybody trying to follow this in other literature. The 1784 5th and final edition of the Premier Grand Lodge would seem to be of utmost importance to historians researching the differences between the Premier Grand Lodge and the United Grand Lodge of England. Unfortunately, the text of the 1784 Northwick edition is not available, except on microfilm. So we're looking for a copy of that, a PDF. See? Brotherly love, relief from truth, eh? Brotherly love includes all who are good and true, of honor and honesty. Everybody in an apron? All right. You be the judge. Relief means solving denied problems and righting perpetuated wrongs. Truth means acknowledging contradictions, speaking up and speaking out. There you go. So, all people are born free and equal in dignity and rights. Universal Declaration of Human Rights, huh? They're endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. Everyone is entitled to all the rights and freedoms set forth in this declaration without distinction of any kind, such as race, color, sex, language, religion, political or other opinion, national or social origin, property, birth, or other status. That was adopted worldwide without dissent, Universal Declaration of Human Rights and 1948. If it doesn't matter to you, it doesn't matter. Really? So, is it good enough just to have, you know, the scholarship that you expect is something that's just going to agree with everything that's going through your mind? Really? Well, close the schools, close the libraries. That's closed-minded. Everything about us seems to stretch us out there a little bit further than that, doesn't it? That's hard. It's hard being a Freemason. It's bloody hard. Nobody told us that. They said, well, you know, come in, it's a good time. I'm nervous. See you on your journey. Wonderful. Blah, blah, blah. Nobody says, it's a damn hard thing to do. You read, you think, you talk, you debate, you reason, and you begin to change. Change isn't easy. Whoever said that, you're daft, man. Half the world is composed of people who have something to say and can't. And the other half is of people who have nothing to say and keep on saying it. Amen, Robert Frost. Really? The brain is a wonderful organ, he says. It starts working the moment we get up in the morning and does not stop until you get into the office. A mother takes 20 years to make a man of her boy, and another woman makes a fool of him in 20 minutes. Education, he says, is the ability to listen to almost anything without losing your temper or your self-confidence. Yeah. Freemasonry, it exercises our minds and our brains to be able to hold competing ideas in our minds at the same time. To be able to hold the right and the wrong. To be able to understand the right and the wrong of it at the same time. Try it. Try it. Fascinating, eh? 1937, King George VI of England was invested as the past Grand Master. Well, well, well. And we're happy that we're so pleased that he did. And that, you know, same year, 1940 it was, Knopp and Jones published A Short History of Freemasonry in 1730. Can you imagine that? It wasn't that long ago, man. Yeah. It was only 1937 that the Golden Gate Bridge suspension bridge was completed in San Francisco. That was a pretty major engineering feat. You know, if you think about the history of engineering around the world, that was... It was also the year Hitler moved to Austria. Get a job, buddy. Get a job. I want to hear more about living in the Enlightenment, eh? The Constitution, this process of Freemasonry and this notion of constitutional, structure. And we've been tackling this with the assistance of Margaret Jacob. Now, you don't have to walk around thinking that this is definitive, but if you can find more accurate information, bring it up. This is a serious puncher when this mind, this scholar says something is a fact. I mean, these are folks that spend years and years. This is what they enjoy. They're not sitting there chewing their fingernails saying, oh my goodness, I have to turn out some pulp to please the world. People that are, their confidence is wrapped up in finding the source information that hasn't been revealed yet. And then they try and weave that together with other known facts. And we see the material coming up. Margaret Jacob, just what she has done for Freemasonry is it's defining, really. Just defining, startling. I don't know what this does to the misogynists in the order that just can't, those boys that can't get their head around gender issues. You know, I don't know what that does to them. Be kind to them. They're just flopping around like little fishies on the shore after the tide goes out. Kick them out into the deeper tide pools. The use of the term party, let's talk about this. You know, where did this idea of the party? This brought the Dutch directly from English. This was brought into Dutch directly from English. Of course, you know, our languages are, you know, are mixtures. It possessed an explicitly political meaning. Ooh. The Dutch Grand Lodge. Interesting time, huh? Lots of activity and trade going on. Banking, insurances, you know, and a bit of skullduggery, yes. So there was, it had to form rules of trade to ensure that that some of these nefarious actors were being caught and dealt with under the law. The Dutch Grand Lodge consistently used it against rebellious lodges. This is the term party. They formed a party, is what the Dutch Grand Lodge would say. Well, let's go get them. You know, they're not agreeing with us. So they formed a party, and that's how they got around it. You know, just making that kind of glib statement. We still see that kind of nonsense used today and in the press and in, you know, people of some degrees of celebrity and power. In the 1760s, the Grand Lodge, still quarreling with other lodges, accused a lodge in Utrecht, this is where our friend Rousset had set it up during his exile, of being a party, a political party they're talking about, you know? By then, however, the dispute with the Amsterdam Lodge had been settled, and in 1759, with the election of a new Grand Master, the dispute was buried. And a new constitution was granted to, la bien-aimée. It, in turn, directed its members to forget and leave aside all events of the past, as if they had never happened, to respect the highly noble and respectable Grand Master, and to consider all legitimate lodges of these countries as worthy fellow members of the same body. A tenuous and fragile unity had been at least temporarily achieved. The other lodges were not permitted to have correspondence with the forgiven rebels. Oh, well, we can't have that. None of that conversation. Then you know how this lot would, hurting Masons is truly like hurting cats. How many would say, well, we're not going to talk to them, you know, that's like, yeah, right. And everybody, all of you out there would say, right, never going to happen again. Yeah, I'm a good little boy. Jesus, funny. But Pierre Brunel, the old master that Rousset had nominated as his replacement, still objected that the new leadership of Le Bien-Aimée was illegitimate and usurping. As late as the 1780s, Brunel appeared in the lodge and somewhat mysteriously presented it with the missing document, the original constitution, or a copy, from the Grand Lodge of Scotland, dated the 26th of December, 1755. The lodge sealed it away in its archives. Throughout the 1760s, disputes over the legitimacy of one or another lodge, or over the right of a brother from one lodge to be admitted to another, continued to be commonplace. At this distance, the emotion generated by these disputes is hard to recreate. The threat to a lodge's honor, the issue of obedience to duly constituted authority, the yearning for harmony and respectability, these were real desires expressed in those words and emotively. Where another lodge tried to settle the dispute between Le Bien-Aimée and the Grand Lodge, the mediator spoke about its desire, like in former times, to join hands and hearts fraternally together and to promote the construction of the respectable temple. It seems appropriate to relate these controversies of 1756, including the amnesia expressed toward Rousset and his lodge. To events in the larger society. In the mid-1750s, the security of the Dutch Republic was deeply threatened by the specter of another French invasion. It became painfully clear in the face of Dutch economic decline that Dutch defenses were weak and that the will to continue in the Triple Alliance with Britain and Austria was no longer there. In the ensuing Anglo-French War on the continent, the Dutch Republic opted for neutrality and the alliance collapsed. That collapse is the background of the so-called Diplomatic Revolution of 1756, which brought forth the realignment of Austria with its old enemy, France. With regard to international alliances, the Republic was now adrift. Its recent oligarchy had once again chosen neutrality. In opposition, increasingly nationalistic voices could now be heard to speak of the Vaderland in terms of its corruption and decay. The decision to establish a national Grand Lodge also reflects a growing sense of national identity. The Grand's insistence that we are a great power echoes it, just as the decision may also reflect a loosening of the ties to the British alliance. This is not to suggest that in 1756, Dutch Freemasonry lost its generally orangist complexion. But Orangism, especially in mid-century, could also be strongly nationalistic. Equality and its contradiction. There are now elements within the fraternity that were less than eager to bow to the authorities of The Hague, however national their claims to legitimacy. The antagonism of the Amsterdam brothers may reflect the historic tension between Amsterdam and The Hague, but more likely it also signals a disillusionment with neutralism on the part of Schroeder, Rousset, and their brothers. They were no less identified with the Dutch Republic than were their brothers in the Grand Lodge. The fact that it now asks that all lodges keep their records in Dutch rather than in French, which was fashionable in elite circles, could hardly have impressed the Amsterdam Lodge. Unlike more elite lodges, it had been doing so since 1754. La Bien Amie's dedication to what it called a pure English type of Freemasonry may also signal its concern over the foreign, noticeably French influences found in other lodges, especially in the high society of The Hague. The independence of La Bien-Aimée also signals a tension with authority that in subsequent decades never disappeared. Its records for those decades document the tension. We'll see later in the 1770s and the 1780s, the Lodge's orators dwelt upon the meaning of republicanism, both in ancient Rome and in their own Masonic system. In 1782, La Bien-Aimée proposed that the Grand Lodge conclude an alliance with the lodges of North America, now declared independent by this republic. The Grand Lodge agreed, but was careful, given its pro-British sentiments, to suggest that it simply recognized all Masons spread over the surface of the earth. In 1783, La Bien-Aimée also welcomed a brother from Philadelphia and congratulated him on his newly won freedom. From early in its history, La Bien-Aimée assumed a posture of opposition. See, the struggle, the connections here, absolute connections, that the connections with a past, the connections of, when we think about the struggle and revolution, if we think about 1776 and think about the domination of, you know, of the oration by the American historians, that was something that was in a context of what was happening in France and in the Netherlands and in Austria and in England, the shift in thinking. And people were deadly serious about looking at other countries to see how their events unfurled. The same as we do today. Somebody experiments with tweaking of the system. As you can imagine, we're in major banking systems that are tweaking constantly. And then everybody is watching the results. So we tweak the World Bank, and then we see, well, what effect does that have? And is there a trickle? Well, and then they try and readjust again. Remember, the economics is speculative, isn't it? It's not based on the purity and clarity of mathematics. Oh, it uses the validity of statistics, but I've seen a lot of Masons stick their tongue firmly in their cheek and laugh about statistics and the capacity to manipulate. It's a shame, but you don't really get to manipulate a whole lot of. You get to manipulate the premises that you come up with. And can people prove anything? Well, no. If something's absurd, the mathematics doesn't make it unabsurd. If something is just daft, even though somebody can come up with the mathematics to prove it, it is still daft. Cyril's grandson can even figure that one out. Ah, man. Remember, I like Robert Frost. A liberal, he says, is a man too broad-minded to take his own side in a quarrel. Oh, the Greeks, he had obviously read the Greeks, Greek philosophies. Education, he says, doesn't change life much. It just lifts trouble to a higher plane of regard. Yeah, we're able to understand and resolve conflict that you without it, it would be very, very difficult. Some say the world will end in fire. Some say in ice. What were you reading, Robert? Happiness makes up its height for what it lacks in length. Happiness makes up in height for what it lacks in length. Savor the moments if you're happy. Oh, go around being daffy as hell. You know, if you've got to have one of those, you know, you're in that stupor where life is all good, go right ahead. Sure, shit. Why not? That's what turns you on. Who's anybody to say otherwise? It's just good. God, man. Really? Anyway. 1840, the uniform penny postage was adopted by England. We've got a postage in Canada is going up on March 31st. What's it going up to? Is it 85 cents or 81 cents for a stamp? Check it out, you know, yeah. You'll notice the morale of people working in that field. They're all grumpy and really it's quite unpleasant to go around still. Beer. What could make this day even better is to move on with our history of the world in six glasses. Mm-mm. Let's take on, you know, for the world's a serious place, so we have to dress and be somber about it, or can we actually smile and enjoy the happiness? That doesn't last. Knowing it doesn't last, but just appreciate it. Well, as we get into this a little more detail, we'll find that there is a point to being able to sit down amongst us and having a drink and being able to relax and to talk, to think, to be together. There is a purpose. And I'm not talking about those boys that lose all control and turn, you know, have to be taken out to the woodshed when they have a little bit to drink. Those children don't. You know, we'll leave those for another, you know, we'll find another planet, put all those boys on that, where they can sit around sulking and being all that they can be together. Ah, dear. And most of the change we think we see is in life is due to truths being in and out of favor. Ouch. Ouch. Since beer was a gift from the gods, Maybe I should have some ink done on my arm to say that. It was also the logical thing to present as a religious offering. Oh, we're being serious here. Beer was certainly used in religious ceremonies, agricultural fertility rites, and funerals by the Sumerians and the Egyptians. And a lot of, you know, old school. People would toast at the wakes, wouldn't they? And so it seems likely that its religious use goes back further still. Indeed, the religious significance of beer seems to be common in every beer-drinking culture, whether in the Americas, Africa, or Eurasia. The Incas offered their cup, their beer called chincha, to the rising sun in a golden cup and poured it on the ground or spat out the first mouthful as an offering to the gods of the earth. Is that the same as, you know, coughing up your first mouthful and it all runs down your T-shirt? Probably not. The Aztecs offered their beer called pulque to Mehehua, the goddess of fertility. In China, beers made from mullet and rice were used in funerals and other ceremonies. The practice of raising a glass to wish somebody good health, a happy marriage or a safe passage into the afterlife, or to celebrate the successful completion of a project, is the modern echo of the ancient idea that alcohol has the power to invoke supernatural forces. Chin chin. Beer and farming, the seeds of modern... Some anthropologists have even suggested that beer may have played a central role in the adoption of agriculture, one of the turning points of human history. Farming paved the way for the emergence of civilization by creating food surpluses, freeing some members of the society from the need to produce food and enabling them to specialize in particular activities and crafts, and so setting humanity on the path to the modern world. Whatever the reason, we have, you know, let's add that to some of the other more serious-minded reasons that this adaptation occurred. This first happened in the Fertile Crescent, starting around, that's Africa, isn't it? Yeah, around 9,000 BC, as people began cultivating barley and wheat deliberately rather than simply gathering wild grains for consumption and storage. Cultivation. Of course, now you remember for a while they were experimenting with them before the Common Era. Well, that, you know, instead of BC and AD, you know, Common Era, well, that one's been put back on the shelf. Like, really, was it necessary? It didn't serve a purpose. Caused a lot of confusion. Didn't serve what it intended to do. So just in case you're wondering. Here we go. Instead of gathering, you know, we find the barley that we need and we're wandering around and it's growing naturally, we started to cultivate it. Made sense. More people, more product. Of course, the switch from hunting to gathering to farming was a gradual transition over a few thousand years as deliberately cultivated crops played an increasingly significant dietary role. Yet in the grand scheme of human history, it appears in an eye blink. Humans had been hunter-gatherers ever since humankind diverged from the apes. We suggest, because we weren't around, nobody wrote it down. But there's evidence, around 7 million years earlier. Then they suddenly took up farming. Suddenly, in, you know, a couple of thousand years. Exactly why the switch to farming occurred and occurred when it did is still a debate, and there are dozens of theories. Good. So out of the dozens, one of them is going to be more accurate than others. And in the meantime, I'm pretty sure I'm not the one to be able to point out which one. Perhaps the amount of food available to hunter-gatherers in the Fertile Crescent diminished. For example, either because of climate changes or because some species died out or were hunted, overhunted. Another possibility is that a more sedentary but still hunter-gatherer lifestyle increased human fertility, allowing the population to grow and creating demand for new sources of food. Or perhaps once beer had been discovered and its consumption had become socially and ritually important, there was a greater desire to ensure the availability of grain by deliberate farming rather than relying on wild grains. Farming was, according to this view, adopted partly in order to maintain the supply of beer. Tempting though it is to attribute the adoption of agriculture entirely to beer, it seems most likely that beer drinking was just one of many factors that helped to tip the balance away from hunting and gathering toward farming and a sedentary lifestyle based on small settlements. Once this transition had begun, a ratchet effect took hold. The more farming was relied on as a means of food production as a particular community, and the more its population grew, the harder it was to go back to the old nomadic lifestyle based on hunting and gathering. Beer drinking would also have assisted the transition to farming in a more subtle way, because long-term storage of beer was difficult and complete fermentation takes up to a week. Most beer would have been drunk much sooner while still fermenting. Such a beer would have had a relatively low alcohol content by modern standards, but would have been rich in suspended yeast, which dramatically improved its protein and vitamin content. The high level of vitamin B in particular would have compensated for the decline in the consumption of meat, the usual source of that vitamin as hunting gave way to farming. Furthermore, since it was made using boiled water, beer was safer to drink than water, which quickly becomes contaminated with human waste in even the smallest settlements. Although the link between contaminated water and ill health was not understood until modern times, humans quickly learned to be wary of unfamiliar water supplies and to drink where possible from clean running streams away from human settlements. Hunter-gatherers did not have to worry about contaminated water supplies since they lived in small mobile bands and left their human waste behind when they moved on. In other words, beer helped to make up for the decline in food quality as people took up farming, provided a safe form of liquid nourishment, and gave groups of beer-drinking farmers a comparative nutritional advantage over non-beer drinkers. That's interesting. Farming spread through the Fertile Crescent between 7,000 and 5,000 BC with an increasing number of plants and animals, starting from sheep and goats, which were domesticated, and new irrigation techniques made farming possible in the hot, dry lowlands of Mesopotamia and the Nile Valley of Egypt. A typical farming village of the period consisted of huts built from clay and reed mats, and perhaps some other grander houses built of sun-dried brick. Beyond the village would have been fields where cereals and dates and other crops were cultivated, with a few sheep and oxen tethered together or penned nearby. Wild fowl, fish, and game, when available, supplemented the diet. It was a very different lifestyle from the hunting and gathering of just a few thousand years earlier, and a tradition toward an even more complex society had begun. Settlements from that period often had a storehouse where valuable items were kept, including sacred objects and stores of surplus food. These storehouses were definitely communal, since they were far larger than would have been needed by any single family. And keeping surplus food in the storehouse was one way to ward off future food shortages. Ritual and religious activity in which the gods were called upon to ensure a good harvest was another. As these two activities became intertwined, deposits of surplus food came to be seen as offerings to the gods, and the storehouses became temples. To ensure all villagers were pulling their weight, contributions to the common storehouse were recorded using small clay tokens found throughout the Fertile Crescent from as early as 8,000 BC. Such contributions were justified as religious offerings by administrative priests who lived off the surplus food and directed communal activities, such as the construction of buildings and the maintenance of irrigation systems. Thus were sown the seeds of accountancy, writing, and bureaucracy. The idea that beer provided some of the impetus for this dramatic shift in the nature of human activity after millions of years of hunting and gathering remains very controversial. But the best evidence for the importance of beer in prehistoric times is its extraordinary significance to the people of the first great civilizations. For although the origins of this ancient drink inevitably remain shrouded in mystery and conjecture, there is no question that the daily lives of Egyptians and Mesopotamians, young and old, rich and poor, were steeped in beer. Here's a proverb from Mesopotamia, 2000 BC. Pleasure, it is beer. Discomfort, it is an expedition. You know, that's discomfort. And in the, even earlier, 2200 BC, from the Egyptian, an Egyptian proverb, the mouth of a perfectly contented man is filled with beer. The world's first cities arose in Mesopotamia, the land between the streams. The name given to the area between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers that roughly corresponds to modern Iraq. Most of the inhabitants of these cities were farmers who lived within the city walls and walked out to tend their fields each morning. Administrators and craftsmen who did not work in the fields were the earliest humans to live entirely urban lives. Wheeled vehicles trundled through the matrix of city streets. People bought and sold goods in bustling marketplaces. Religious ceremonies and public holidays passed by in an increasingly regular cycle. Remember, in Athens, it was a daily event. There were constant celebrations to the various gods. And people like you and me would have, in the sense of devotion, would have devoted a part of every single day to presenting a sacrifice or recognizing or the ritual, participating in ritual of the various gods. Central to life? Yeah, obviously. Religious ceremonies and public holidays pass by in a regular cycle. Even the proverbs of the times have a regular world weariness. As this, here's an interesting one. He who possesses much silver may be happy. He who possesses much barley may be happy, but he who has nothing at all can sleep. Exactly why people chose to live in large cities rather than small villages remains unclear. It was probably the result of several overlapping factors. People may have wanted to be near important religious or trading centers, for example, and in the case of Mesopotamia, security may have been a significant motivation. The lack of natural boundaries, Mesopotamia is largely just this flat, open plain, meant the area was subject to repeated invasions and attacks. From around 4300 BC, villages began to band together, forming ever larger towns and eventually cities, each of which sat at the center of its own system of fields and irrigation channels. By 3000, the city of Uruk, the largest in its day, had a population of around 50,000 and was surrounded by a circle of fields 10 miles in radius. Whoa. By 2000 BC, almost the entire population of southern Mesopotamia was living in a few dozen large city-states called Uruk, Ur, Lagash, Urudi, and Nippur. Thereafter, Egypt took the lead, and its cities, such as Memphis and Thebes, grew to become the ancient world's largest. These two earliest examples of civilization, a word that simply means living in cities, were different in so many ways. Political unification enabled Egyptian culture to endure almost unchanged for nearly 3,000 years. For example, while Mesopotamia was the scene of constant political and military upheaval, and in one vital respect they were similar, both cultures were made possible by an agricultural surplus, in particular an excess of grain. This surplus not only fed a small elite of administrators and craftsmen for the need to produce their own food, but also funded vast public works such as canals, temples, and pyramids. As well as being the local medium of exchange, grain was the basis of the national diet in both Egypt and Mesopotamia. It was a sort of edible money, and it was consumed in both solid and liquid forms as beer and bread. So, next time we're going to come back and we're going to talk a bit about the drink of the civilized man. Yeah. The recorded history of beer and indeed of everything else begins in Sumer, a region of southern Mesopotamia where writing first began to emerge around 3400 BC. Fantastic. So we'll be back with you on the 9th of March. We'll pick that one up. How do we, you know, the progression that we're going through here is beer in Mesopotamia and Egypt, and then it will, no pun intended, flow into the wine in Greece and Rome, the spirits in the colonial period, coffee in the Age of Reason, and then tea in the British Empire, and then Coca-Cola and the rise of America. So, there you have it, eh? I think it's kind of an interesting period and an interesting way of looking at it, you know, as a foodstuff. Is that enough? Yeah, I think so. Enough. I want to play a little tune for you. This one, just pensive, thoughtful. Sets a mood, hey? This is maybe I'll start off the next program with some of the music from my past that, you know, wasn't all just screaming and carrying on. It was a lot of serious-minded things happening back in my period of life. When I was a boy. And it seems that we were exposed and had advantage. We had access for the very first time. We not only went through transistor radios, but Walkman, and then whatever else we have today. We live in the era of communication, don't we? And we have all of the advantages of all of that. And it's just remarkable that we have this sense that change is happening faster and faster. We're just becoming more aware of it. The pace has always been like this. It's been screaming along. Only now we're able to say, well, you know, there's Philip, and he's over on the other side of the world, and this is what Philip is up to. Well, we know more and more about that, and Philip can look over our shoulders and see what kind of things that we're up to. Well, we never had that advantage. It used to be, you know, what would it take? A couple of months for news to reach us? Now, if something odder is going on, his children can Twitter pictures of it instantly before the authorities can get their hands on it. So we're really changing that struggle with censorship. Man, now everything that we see isn't necessarily as it seems, but it's a damn sight closer than some of the spin that's been put on a lot of things in our press around the world. It's not just here. There's no demons in the world. We're all basically alike. Yeah. Ira, can I talk to you about something, a little bit of Ooga Booga? You don't mind? You'll keep this under your hat? So much for the oath, right? Everybody takes an oath of secrecy. Well, we know how long that lasts. That's a tissue of fill in the blank yourself. Why do men today seem unable to hold their oaths? And we have old boys walking around and painting, old boys, young guys, bragging that their wives are part of the ritual and thinking, really? Their wives have coached them? Really? Oh, that's a practical reason, you know. Really? So much for keeping your word, eh? Oh, my. Let's not bring up those unpleasant, that kind of unpleasantness. Each of us has to figure out who we can trust, truly. And since we can't, we don't talk on that level, I've only shared material about the order with people that I trust deeply. Well, best that I couldn't figure that out. I was so daft, I took it all seriously. So if you're not to say anything, you don't say anything. Who knew that was just a joke? Who knew that you could flip signs in public? Who knew? I just try to distance myself from some people that have some very strange ideas. God bless them. They're God's creatures, just not mine. Here, I want to talk to you about an invisible college. Do you mind? Yeah, I'll name drop a little bit here, you know. Of course. According to the manifestos, the eight original disciplines, disciples of Christian Rosenkreutz, were known as the Invisibles or the Invisible College because they pursued. Now, you go and find it. Here, I'll spell this. You can go and Google this on your own. You're big boys. Christian, the first name, Rosenkreutz, Rosenkreutz. Because they pursued their revolutionary ideas in absolute secrecy, their existence unknown to the world. Excuse me, Chris, I'm reading about this. So much for absolute, you know, and for the boys to think, oh my goodness, we're breaking down the rules of propriety by talking on air like this. Well, where do you think the information is stored? It's in libraries. The Hagia Sophia claims to be wanting a copy of everything. And thank goodness they are. So, oh, prying eyes, listening to what we're doing. Time to take a deep breath, then, if that's the way you feel. Better that we start with our own membership and getting them to shut up and start holding them accountable for blabbing and talking freely about the things that are shouldn't be said. There we go. Sorry. I apologize to the hall out there. Francis Bacon. All right, wait, before I go. In England in the 17th century, a real-life brotherhood of scholars steeped in alchemy and natural magic took shape in apparent echo and direct application of the Rosicrucian ideal. And like their supposedly fictional forebears, they were known as the Invisible College. The story of the Invisible College starts with Sir Francis Bacon, 1561 to 1626, an Elizabethan lawyer and a Jacobean statesman. Bacon was the preeminent philosopher of science of his time, not because of his own scientific discoveries, but because of the project he developed for scientific advancement and the role of science in society. In this period, however, the word science was not in use, and what Bacon actually discussed was something very similar to the Rosicrucians: the use of natural philosophy and natural magic for applied ends. At times, his work reads much more like the Rosicrucian manifestos. In his 1605 book, The Advancement of Learning, for instance, he describes a fraternity in learning and illumination. In his posthumously published New Atlantis, 1626, Bacon describes a utopian society run by an institution called Solomon's House, which is similar in both the Rosicrucian ideal and more specific to Andrea's a utopian Christianopolis. In fact, Bacon may well have corresponded with Andrea and his circle and have influenced and been influenced by the Rosicrucian manifesto. This has led to claims that Bacon was actually the secret master of the Rosicrucians. But in practice, there were important differences between his project and the Rosicrucian one. Bacon believed that science should be an open public process, and he was explicitly opposed to secret societies and hidden knowledge. Bacon's work helped encouraged the network of correspondence between natural philosophers in 17th century England that came to be called the Invisible College. Despite the sinister name, this was in fact an informal group dedicated in principles and practices that had a distinctly Rosicrucian flavor, pursuing alchemy, the Kabbalah, mathematics, natural philosophy, and magic for the good of all mankind, and with the eventual aim of reforming society. Inspired by Bacon and also by Dee, Flood, Mayer, and others like them, the Invisible College eventually founded a formal society, which in 1660 gained the seal of royal approval from Charles II and became the Royal Society. Thanks to men like Robert Boyle, Robert Hooke, and Isaac Newton, all assumed by conspiracy theorists to have been members of the Rosicrucian fraternity, the Royal Society would become the birthplace of the scientific revolution. In some ways, thanks to their influence on Bacon and other English scholars, the Rosicrucians could be seen as the midwives of that revolution. This is different, however, from saying that the Invisible College and the Royal Society were actually Rosicrucian institutions or were set up by Rosicrucians. At least one important member of the Invisible College and an early member of the Royal Society was a Rosicrucian of sorts, the antiquarian Elias Ashmole, 1617 to 1692, recorded in his diary that in 1646, he and several others, including the astrologer William Lilly, founded a Rosicrucian lodge in London. This is the first recorded instance of an actual Rosicrucian fraternity as opposed to a fictional one, but it is almost certainly also the first example of a pseudo-Rosicrucian brotherhood. Ashmole had been recently initiated into Freemasons, and it seems likely that he and others started their own Masonic lodge in London and described it as Rosicrucian because they sympathized with the Rosicrucian agenda that they had learned about, not because they had any actual chain of initiation by real Rosicrucians. In so doing, Ashmole, Lilly, and others were foreshadowing what would eventually happen in the 18th century when Masonic pseudo-Rosicrucians became commonplace. The next instance of what were probably pseudo-Rosicrucians was in 1710, when Sigmund Richter, writing under the pseudonym Sincerus Renatus, published a perfect and true preparation of the philosophical stone according to the secret of the Brotherhoods of the Golden and Rosy Cross. Richter gave a list of 52 laws of the Brotherhood, revealing, for instance, that there must be no more than 63 members, that Catholics could be admitted, and that when the brethren meet, they shall salute each other in the following manner. I won't read that. There's no purpose. They had a manner of greeting. Whether Richter actually founded such a brotherhood at this time, it remained a fantasy isn't really clear, but it became a reality in the 1750s as part of the Rosicrucian flowering in Freemasonry. So check out Societas Rosicruciana and the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. Check that out. Sort of related topics. This fits under esoteric, occult, and mystical and political types of organizations. Yeah. It even gets around to remember the beheading of Charles I. Well, his son, Charles II, was known to be a very avid alchemist. Yeah. And the second degree of the Royal Order of Scotland, a rite founded in 1750 at The Hague in Holland, is the Rosy Cross. Anyway, there you go. We'll come back, shall we? We'll come back. We'll talk. Yeah. It'll be good. Now we have to say goodbye and wrap this up. Thank you very much for joining me today. It's been my pleasure to have you here. How about a little bit of music to say goodbye? This is lighthearted, isn't it? No, I was thinking of a bit more of Rachmaninoff, but no, I think I'd like to just something a little bit pensive, yeah? And, we have something. The very last piece I'll leave you with is from somebody Canadian, just because I can. And it's important that you take care of, that we all, as Freemasons, take care of one another and try and live according to the principles. Read the ancient charges and use them as our touchstones across the stream. They'll keep us living a good life. Don't do it blindly, as if it's a thoughtless effort. Do it consciously, because you've reasoned through and it makes sense to you. I hope you are able to embrace every single day. When you say goodbye and you part from one of the brethren or for people that matter in your life, keep in mind that it may be the last time that you see them. Make the parting wonderful. Make the event spectacular. Commit acts of random Masonic kindness. What else could you do, eh? It's the only decent thing to do, eh? For now.